The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I thought, as I was thinking about what to talk about tonight, I was reflecting on the path as a whole, how we tend to practice here in this culture, in these places. We tend to be very inwardly focused on the meditation piece of our practice. And that's a piece of what the Buddha taught, but when I think about the entirety of what the Buddha taught, when I think about the whole of the path and the practice, there's an awful lot of the teachings that are relational. There's a very relational aspect to what the Buddha taught. I mean, the foundation of the teaching is around looking at suffering, stress, and can we be free of that? Can we be free of that suffering or that stress? And often our exploration of that is inwardly. Can we be find the ways? And a lot of what we are encouraged to do is to look at the ways in which our own habits, our patterns, contribute to how we struggle and how we suffer. But in the Buddhist teaching, he often encourages us to reflect. One teaching he gave to his own son, he said, reflect before you act whether your action will create affliction or stress or distress for yourself or another or for both. And while you're acting, check it out. Is it going to create stress or distress for yourself or another? After you've acted, reflect on whether it has created distress for yourself or another. And so very relational to his 7-year-old son, he was encouraging a very relational approach to the practice, looking at how our actions impact not only ourselves, but others. And then as I think about the Eightfold Path, the teachings through a good part of the Eightfold Path are very relational. The wisdom basket of the Eightfold Path, wise understanding and wise intention. This intention aspect speaking to what the Buddha was talking about with his son. Before you act, think, is this going to create harm? Looking at what's the intention with which you're acting? How are you carrying out this action? And in the teaching on right intention, the encouragement is to act with compassion, with kindness, and then with simplicity, with renunciation, with letting go. And so two of those are really about relationship, non-harming and kindness. So to look at our intentions and actions and look at how they land with others. And then in the next three aspects of the Eightfold Path, they're all relational. Wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. How do we engage in the world? Talking about how we speak to people, how we act with people, what kind of livelihood we do. And so there's a lot, actually, a lot of what the Buddha taught was relational, was looking at how we are with our fellow human beings. And so I wanted to explore that tonight a little bit through the framework of some of the Buddhist teachings on friendship. One very famous, I'm going to use some of the teachings, some of the quotes from some of the suttas in this talk, and also ask you to reflect a little bit during this time. So there's one, a kind of famous time where Ananda, one of the Buddha's attendants, had this kind of insight or recognition, and he's got this kind of nice energy, Ananda. At least that's the way it seems like he comes across to me when he comes to the Buddha. He always seems to got this like, oh, it's so great. I see this thing and it's so great. The Dharma is so great. And I really get a sense of how much Ananda loves the Dharma in these interchanges with the Buddha. And at one point he came to the Buddha and said something like, I see, Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. And the Buddha, I have the sense there's a really congenial and lovely relationship between the Buddha and Ananda, but it often seems like the Buddha has to correct the Ananda's interpretation or his understandings. And so Ananda's coming to the Buddha with this like, oh, I see, this is so amazing how important friendship is. It's half of the holy life. And the Buddha said, well, don't say that, Ananda. This is the entire of the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When one has a good friend, it is to be expected that they will develop and cultivate the Eightfold Path. And so essentially pointing to how good friendship basically helps us to start, moves us onto the path. Without good friendship, we wouldn't start. And so it's crucial, these friendships. And then as other places in the texts, it talks about in cultivating various wholesome qualities of mind. It says, like for instance, concentration. What are the supports for concentration? And there's this long list of like 11 things that support concentration, like living in a simple environment and seclusion and things like that. But at the end of many of these lists, it says, one of the things that supports concentration, one of the things that supports equanimity, one of the things that supports all of the factors of awakening is good friendship and good conversation. And so again, through the whole interchange, through the interchange with in relationship, the path develops and we begin to understand how to walk this path, how to engage in a way that we begin to understand how our minds contribute to our struggles and our stress. So there's a couple of teachings that the Buddha offers about qualities of friendship. And this one is kind of the structure I wanted to look at for this talk. I'll read this little piece. A friend should be followed when he possesses 7 factors. What 7? One gives what is difficult to give. One does what is difficult to do. One patiently endures what is difficult to endure. One reveals one's own secrets. One keeps your secrets. One does not abandon one in misfortune. And one does not despise one because of one's loss. A friend should be followed when one possesses when they possess these factors. So these are qualities of a good spiritual friend, is my understanding. A friend that will support us in being curious about watching our own minds and engaging in helpful and wholesome ways. And so I'd like to look at each of these. Some of them are kind of obvious or, what one reveals one's, they reveal their own secrets, they keep your secrets, does not abandon one in misfortune. Those kind, the last 4, and does not despise one because of one's loss. Well, that last one we'll spend some time with too, but those middle 3, those seem to be pretty familiar to us. You know, we appreciate friends that know how to keep their own that know how to keep our secrets, who know how to keep confidence. We appreciate when a friend can share their confidences with us, and so they can be revealing to us to tell us, here's what I'm looking at, here's what I'm working with. And we also appreciate a friend who hangs out with us when we're struggling, So somebody who can be with us in distress. So does not abandon one in misfortune. And then the last one, they do not despise one because of one's loss. I spent some time thinking about that one, and the word despise is maybe a little odd for us, but there are ways, I think, that we find that we are uncomfortable when somebody has a loss. Now, there's a lot, the woman who's, I think, the CFO of Facebook has been in the news a lot lately, Sheryl Sandberg. She's written a book about her loss of her husband and how she navigated that time. And one of the things she really found amazing and hard was that people basically, you know, they wouldn't speak to her. It's like they were so uncomfortable, with the loss, with her loss, with the overwhelming nature of her loss, that they just had no idea how to speak with her. And so there was this kind of feeling of distance and almost loss of relationship because of that. And one of the big things she says is, you know, when she talked to people and they said, well, I didn't want to remind you of the fact that you lost your husband by asking, you know, by saying, I'm so sorry about your loss. And she said, you're not going to remind me about this. I'm cognizant of it every moment of every day. And so, you know, it's just this kind of way in which we through the meeting of somebody else's discomfort, we have so much discomfort ourselves that we separate. We can separate ourselves from people. And so a good friend, I think, partly what this is speaking to is that a good friend is somebody who can be comfortable with discomfort, who can stand with us in misfortune and not pull away, who can... I think part of our misunderstanding, perhaps, is that we think we have to do something to fix somebody when they have a loss, or that we have to have something to say or to offer. And often, I think a big piece of support is our presence, our willingness to say, "Wow, this must be hard, and I'm willing to sit here with you. You know, if you'd like to say something, I'm here." Or we could just have tea together or something. So I've actually found that presence in that kind of situation is one of the best ways to be a friend when somebody is going through something difficult. Just that simple presence. And this is what we do in our meditation practice. We practice being present for our own discomfort. And how can we not push that away? And so this is a way in which we can transfer that or translate that into relationship, that we can begin to also begin to be comfortable with the discomfort in relationship. So the first three, though, well, also I like to think about these not only as qualities that we look for in a friend, because here it says, a friend should be followed when they possess these seven factors. And so that's kind of talking about what we look for in a friend, but I also think it's pointing to us, how can we be a good friend to cultivate these qualities in ourselves? These first three, one gives what is difficult to give, one does what is difficult to do, and one endures what is difficult to endure. Those I had to reflect on a little bit. You know, what does that mean? What is being pointed to here? It's not being very specific. One does what is difficult to do. What does that mean? So I'm going to ask you, what are your thoughts? How does that land? What does that evoke for you when a good friend does what is difficult to do? What is that? How does that land for you? Yeah, and let's use the mic, so...
So a couple of, can you hear me?
Yeah, turn the blue one up a little bit.
Okay. The light's on.
Now it's on.
It's okay. On. Yeah.
All right. I must be in a dead spot. So a couple of things come to mind right off the bat. One is a certain kind of generosity of spirit, which could be someone giving things that is difficult to give, whether it's time at a tricky time or that kind of thing. But also true honesty. Deeply honest mirroring, I think, from my perspective, is congruent with what's in the suttas and also what many of us consider deep spiritual friendship to be.
Yes, so deep honesty, but also care that it's not bludgeoning someone with honesty.
Yeah, loving.
Loving, yes. Coming with a loving intention. Yeah, so I think that's a big piece of giving what's difficult to give. You mentioned time, being present, and being truthful. Those are difficult, can be difficult. I think, too, part of what it evokes for me is something along the lines of that truth. We need to also be true to ourselves, which is challenging, in order to offer that to someone else.
Yeah. I would add one other thing, which is admitting one's own faults.
Yes. Yeah. So this is gives what is difficult to give.
Yeah. So I have to admit, not long ago, like maybe before, I was mindful of these things and reflected on them. And then as it became mindful, I noticed that I had this characteristic that if a friend asked me for something, even if it's a small thing, and if it would inconvenience me even slightly, resentment was all that. You know, I just didn't want to do it. And I never reflected that maybe, you know, I should relax and do something for someone that inconveniences me because they're my friend. Honestly, I was like this. I might kind of do it resentfully. But then as I got actually really more in my practice, because then I would reflect and I think, why are you thinking, does that even make sense? And would you want them to treat you that way? Like, you ask that friend to do things and you expect them to do you favors, and then they ask you something and you're immediately resentful. So it just seems like that's even something that's not that hard, right? Just anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a beautiful reflection, though, of how this kind of exploration has an impact on us. You know, and this is, you noticed it as in relationship, something that had an impact on you internally. You know, I think that's true. And I find, too, that when I explore the possibility. I mean, generosity, this exploration of generosity is one of the big relational areas of the Buddha's teaching, is exploring giving. And as we explore giving, we also explore receiving and our relationship in both areas. And I actually find sometimes that receiving is also an area that is something that is a gift. You know, that when we are able to receive something from somebody in a way that's not dismissive or pushing it away, that can be a gift as well. You know, so there's both sides of generosity, the giving and the receiving. And sometimes I find that when somebody is asking me for something, it's also giving me an opportunity to practice generosity. So it's opening that doorway. And so they're giving me a gift by asking me to do something. And sometimes it can be hard to ask. So, thank you. Anybody else want to say anything about the generosity, giving what is difficult to give? Other pieces about that. One of the other things I thought about is, you know, that we maybe explore a good friend, a really good friend might dig deep to give or explore what is the best of myself to give in this situation. How can I most be present in this situation, or most give in this situation? And so giving what is difficult to give, because that is difficult because it takes our own inner work as well to begin to find those edges of being truthful with ourselves. So what about does what is difficult to do? What does that say? Or how does that seem to be a quality of a friend? In what ways does a friend, have you had friends do what is difficult to do or feel like as a friend you've done what is difficult to do?
Well, I guess in this case, you're asking us to do what is difficult to do for our spiritual friendship here, and it's very difficult. And so silence comes out, but, you know, we make the effort to say, well, it's tough.
Yes, yes, that's true. And also to be okay to be comfortable in silence, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I can really frame this in succinct terms, but I'm thinking back to around the time that my marriage was falling apart and how a lot of friends kind of vanished during that time. But this sort of intersects with the last one of being with a friend in loss. There's something that's not so easy about showing up for a person whose life is falling apart.
Yes.
And the friends that did are friends to this day.
Yes.
And many of them were friends for a decade before that, too. And it was really, really striking. I've had a couple of periods in my life that have been difficult where it has really become clear who's willing to do what's difficult to do.
Yeah, and I think that all of these interweave, yeah. All of these, you know, the seven different kinds, they do interweave. And I agree that showing up for misfortune, you know, that is difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, the being with suffering, as I said, that is what we do in our own meditation practice. It's like that's inwardly we explore what does it mean to meet anger when it arises in the mind and not just repress it? What does it mean to meet frustration and confusion when it arises in our own mind and not either feel like we have to jump on it and fix it and get rid of it or bury it? And so that's a difficult thing to do inwardly. And not running away when that's happening externally. And sometimes that's even harder, I think. So, you know, sometimes I think of our practice inwardly as being preparation for a relationship piece of it. You know, it's like, and actually my first practice was very much in the world. And at some point I thought, and I wasn't very interested in meditating early on either. I thought, you know, I don't want to do that. I'm more engaged in the world. And yet, after some period of time of beginning this engagement with looking at in relationship and looking at how my emotions and things were happening in the world, I at some point thought, you know, maybe they call it practice because when you sit in meditation, it gives you practice so that you can do this in the world. And that's definitely one way of being with the practice is to see this interweaving. There are definitely ways that practice in daily life can support our practice on the cushion, and practice on the cushion so support practice in daily life. So I don't see them as separate. One of the things that occurred to me in terms of does what is difficult to do, in terms of, you know, thinking in terms of like the Buddha, you know, it's like the Buddha maybe being the best spiritual friend we all have in a way, in that he set this whole path in motion. In terms of give what's difficult to give, as I think about the story of the Buddha's enlightenment and his waking up, I mean, he did the practice. He did what was difficult to do. He sat and he explored, what does it mean? What does suffering mean? How does it come about? Is it possible to even be free of suffering? So he asked that question and looked into his own mind and found there's an answer. And that that answer isn't just about his own mind, but that it was applicable, that he could teach it to others. And so he did what was difficult to do there by doing the practice himself. And then giving what is difficult to give. It is said that after he woke up, he thought about teaching, and the thought that crossed his mind was something like, what I've found, what I've discovered is pretty subtle. And not many people are going to get this. And it would be really a challenge to be talking to people and not having them understand me. So I don't think I'll teach. So he had that thought to not share, to not give the teachings of the Dharma, but instead just kind of stay in his own freedom. And then a different thought crossed his mind that basically said, somebody will understand. Some people, there will be some people that will understand this. And so I will teach. And so in spite of the fact that he thought it would be very difficult to teach, he taught. And so that, in some ways that I see is the Buddha's own practice through these. Doing what's difficult to do. What we do that's difficult to do is to purify our own minds, to begin to commit ourselves to this work. That's a piece of doing what's difficult to do as a friend, so that we can carry that into relationship. That's one of the things I see that's difficult to do. And then endures what's difficult to endure. To me, this is really enduring suffering. Enduring the suffering without reactivity. So enduring sometimes has this notion of, like, I don't know, slogging through, yeah, something like that, or just like, you know, gritting your teeth and pushing, or, you know, and endurance here, I think, is more about patience and openness rather than slogging through. So it's the exploration of, okay, there's anger arising in my own mind. What does it mean to meet that without feeling impatient about it and without repressing it? What does it mean to open to that? And what happens is we open to things like that. We open to anger, we open to confusion, we open to desire, we open to all of that. We find that those states themselves are, they're painful, they're suffering. And that the first movement that we want to do when we meet suffering in our own experience is to get rid of it, to figure out a way out of it. But that's what we've been doing for so much of our lives, is to, we want something, or we want to get rid of something, and what our minds do is create the story of how great it's going to be when I get that thing or get rid of that thing. And so we're living in a world that is not present, that's not actual and related to what's actually going on. And it's our mind's strategy for avoiding the discomfort of the anger or the wanting, essentially. And so we have a lot of strategies out there for dealing with our habitual reactivity, our habitual emotions. And what we're asked to do in our practice is, instead of engaging in those strategies, to sit with the experience. What is this human experience of anger? What is this human experience of desire? What is this human experience of frustration? And that basically puts us right in the midst of our own suffering. This is the first noble truth. We begin to recognize this is dukkha, this is suffering. And patiently enduring that isn't about gritting your teeth, but it's more about curiosity of is the human experience of this, instead of kind of bypassing that to go to our strategies of how to navigate those difficult emotions. And so this is this patiently enduring what is difficult to endure. This really is what, to me, this is what it is speaking to, is learning how to endure these or be with. Maybe that's it. I like being with. It's a friendlier term. Now, be with anger. What does it mean to open to and be with anger without repressing and without buying into it? It's kind of this delicate dance in the middle way the Buddha talked about, neither repressing nor acting on. That means opening to. And it's hard. It takes courage. It takes patience to have the commitment to open to our own struggles. And likewise, in friendship, it takes an equal courage to open to the struggles, the suffering of others. And our own ability to do that in our own hearts will give us the capacity to do that for someone else. I talked earlier about presence being a gift. You know, so that this again, this is how they interweave, just being present, giving what's difficult to give, giving our presence, being present for somebody. That's a gift that's difficult to give, because we do want to flee sometimes. And at one point I was talking to a friend, and in that conversation my friend landed in a very painful memory, and mentioned to me that that was what was happening. And I just sat there with my friend. And at one point, my friend said, "You know, I don't know what to say." He seemed to think I was like wanting him to say something. I said, "I don't feel like you need to say anything. I'm just willing to sit with you while this is happening for you." And with that, he kind of burst into tears and just kind of went through some kind of a releasing process. And I didn't say anything. And what I was doing, what I was exploring, was just being as present as I could be and not fleeing from what was going on. And about a week or two later, he came back to me. He said, "What were you doing? Were you doing metta?" And I said, "No, I was just trying to be as present as I could be." And I think that speaks to how much the presence and, you know, metta, you know, which basically the word for metta means, it means loving kindness, but the word essentially is based in the Pali word for friendship. And so this presence opens us to this capacity for connection. And I was kind of interested and surprised that what he felt was metta. What I was exploring was just staying as present as I could and not trying to be there with him. And so there's this kind of thing, this kind of ability to be present is such a gift. It's a huge gift to our world if we can be there as a witness. I mean, even look at what's going on in the world right now. Being a witness for this without adding to the fire, but also without fleeing. Being able to speak from wisdom, from compassion, and not from reactivity. What a huge gift to the world, to relationship. So did you have something you wanted to add?
It's not necessarily always difficult to give, but the flip side of what you're talking about is something that I've been exploring my own practice, which is the generosity of giving appreciative joy for others' good fortune.
Yes. Oh, that's great. That's another. And it can be hard to give, actually, when somebody else is doing really well, to not feel like, oh, why not me? Or, you know, that appreciative joy of mudita, of sympathetic joy. It's a beautiful emotion, but actually in the suttas it talks about it's one of the most difficult emotions to cultivate, one of the most difficult relational emotions to cultivate. You know, the we can look at our relational emotions in the open heart, let's say, of the heart that's not constricted and motivated by greed, aversion, and delusion. The relation, the emotions of the open heart include love, include compassion, and sympathetic joy, and these are balanced by equanimity. And the emotion of sympathetic joy, of taking happiness, of being delighted in other people's joy, it's an amazingly beautiful emotion. It's really wonderful, and yet there's so much that I think partly, at least in my own exploration of this, and my exploration around it was not trying to fake it, not trying to pretend I felt it, but being more curious about, oh, I'm not feeling that. What's going on? You know, where's the rub here? And in exploring that over and over again, what I discovered the rub for me was I felt like if somebody else was happy, it meant there was less for me. That's the way happiness worked. That if somebody else has happiness, there's a finite amount of happiness in the world, and if somebody has some, it means I've got less possibility to have it. And I think that probably comes to some extent from our connection of happiness being related to having material things, you know, having things and accumulating things. And if that's how we define happiness, by having things, by having money, by having stuff, there's a limited amount of stuff in the world. There's, you know, you are in, you know, somebody will get a job, somebody else won't get a job. So, you know, there is this kind of, if we're defining happiness based on I got that job or I got that thing, then happiness is kind of almost a zero-sum game. There's only so much to go around. But what we begin to discover, and this is the learning that we explore, what we begin to discover is the kind of happiness that the Buddha is pointing to through renunciation of, you know, we explore renunciation of the happiness of having things. And that begins us to open us to some different kinds of happiness that aren't, that there isn't a bound around. And that we start to see that when we can be delighted in the happiness of others, it's like it multiplies happiness. And the Dalai Lama has a famous quote where he says, it's good to, this must have been years ago because of the way, I'll give you the language that he used, which was, it's good to take happiness and the happiness of others, because then you increase your chances of happiness 6 billion to 1. So now it would be 7.5 billion, I think, because there's that many people on the planet. But if you've got the possibility of taking delight in the delight of others, there's so much possibility for happiness. And I remember one of the first times I noticed this. I was on a retreat, and I looked out a window and I saw a friend of mine doing walking meditation, and she looked so peaceful and so present, and I was just so happy for her in that moment. Just the delight. And I was like, wow. It's like that didn't cost anything. Did you want to say something? Oh, you're just holding the mic. Yeah. There's kind of the connectivity with people. I think these touch into, does what's difficult to do, endures what's difficult to endure, gives what's difficult to give. They touch into some basic qualities that support connectivity. And I've mentioned some of those, the kindness, compassion, the joy. Generosity is another one of those qualities that supports. Generosity and gratitude both. And so exploring that in relationship. one thing I find interesting about generosity, you know, we can practice these things. It's not about pretending you're feeling something you're not, but it's kind of the practice of, as you were talking about before, you know, why not offer something even though I might feel resistant? You know, it's a practice. It becomes a practice. And the best way, at least in my own exploration of this, to explore that as a practice, to explore giving something as a practice if we don't feel generous, is to not deny or repress the feeling of resentment or burdens, being burdened or whatever we're feeling about this, but to fully own that, to fully recognize that, but to step into the act of generosity with the intention or the wish or the hope that it will support the cultivation of this beautiful quality of mind of generosity. Because we see as we start to open in our practice to what does it feel like to resent? I mean, what I heard in your story was that you realized it didn't feel very good to resent. You know, and before we start paying attention, we kind of miss that. So we see it doesn't feel very good to resent, and our heart wants to move in the direction of non-resentment. It wishes, it's like the practice of mindfulness begins to reveal to us those places where we're stuck and where we're struggling in our or suffering in our own experience around our relationships. So we can understand that we do feel that resistance to giving, not try to pretend we don't feel that, and explore, well, okay, what happens if I do this action with the intention to see how it might affect me, how it might shift me or change me. So when we take actions with that as an exploration, with an intention, so taking generous actions with the intention to see how might that generous action rebound on my heart, acknowledging that I have this feeling of resistance to this. There was one period of time where I decided, based on something Joseph Goldstein had said in a talk, he said, I decided one time to, whenever the thought of generosity crossed my mind, to do it. And he said, what surprised me, you know, was not that I was like, you know, it was that it actually didn't happen that much. So I decided to take this practice on, and I found something very similar, actually, that thoughts did, you know, that occasionally thoughts crossed my mind, but it wasn't like I was, you know, bombarded by thoughts of generosity. It was a little bit humbling, actually, to recognize how rarely it came up. But then when it did come up, like I remember one time I was in this museum store. I was in a museum, and I was in this museum store, and there was this little thing that would have been, it was like a puzzle kind of thing that I thought, what occurred in my mind was, oh, that would be a perfect gift for this friend's daughter. And I noticed, oh, there's one of those moments of generosity. And I also noticed immediately the mind saying all these reasons why I shouldn't do it. You know, oh, I haven't been in touch with her for ages, and it'll be really odd to get something out of the blue. And, you know, it's like, really? You know, really? This is what my mind is saying? So after I noticed all of those kind of counter arguments, and it was a little bit more expensive than I typically would have spent for that friend's daughter, but I thought, nope, this was my commitment. I'm going to do this. And so I did it. And, you know, just the delight, ultimately the delight of doing it and the response I got from my friend, it was a delightful thing to have done it. But, you know, it was a real education for me to see just, even for a simple thing like that, how much the mind will come in and say why it shouldn't do something that's so beautiful and so wholesome. So many ideas we have about that. And so we can take them on as practices and see how do they rebound on our minds? How do they influence our minds? And so generosity and love, kindness. We can practice kindness even if we don't necessarily feel kind. And patience, the patiently enduring what's difficult to endure. Practicing patience, that might be something that, like with my friend, and I was practicing, can I be here without fleeing? Can I stay here? And the rewards of that really supported a strengthening of that resolve to keep exploring and keep trying that. Another big area of connection and relationship is the area of ethics, of non-harming. And this is if we are serious for ourselves about wanting to explore how does suffering happen in our own hearts and minds, and exploring in the way that the Buddha talked to his own son about, notice before you act, is this going to create harm for yourself or another? It's like the understanding, if we want to recognize and free ourselves from suffering, that we have to also not contribute to suffering of others. And we see the benefit of ethical conduct of non-harming in an immediate kind of rebound effect of when we are engaged in non-harming actions, we have less to regret. I mean, how often in maybe saying something, you know, speaking with a little bit of harshness or doing something that may be somewhat unkind, how much it lands on us, you know, how much we reverberate around that. And so this is one of the kind of back and forth benefits of engaging in ethical conduct, is that it benefits us from the not having harmful conduct to regret, and it benefits others in that they can feel safe in our presence. It said that we both give ourselves the gift of and the bliss of blamelessness, and we give others the gift of fearlessness when we engage in non-harming conduct. So that's another big area to explore in relationship, is how we engage in refraining from doing things that would create harm. Now this, I mean, we can have, I know that myself coming from a Judeo-Christian tradition, the Ten Commandment style of ethics had a very rigid feeling to it. And it didn't feel so much like an exploration or an investigation around these topics. It was, no, you're not supposed to do this. You don't do this. You don't do that. You don't do that. And to me, it creates a feeling of repression. And my understanding in the Buddhist teaching of non-harming is much more of an investigation. It's the question is, I mean, it's kind of like, it's like these actions the Buddha encourages us, you know, refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from creating harm through sexuality, refraining from false speech, and refraining from intoxicating the mind, that if we are going to be engaged in these actions, it's kind of like a wake-up bell, you know. Very likely, if we're going to engage in one of those actions, there's something going on in our minds that is probably conducive to suffering being created, either in our own hearts or in the world. You know, the act of taking something that doesn't belong to us harms someone else. So But the exploration is not, at least in my understanding of it, it's the exploration of seeing that movement towards wanting to kill or wanting to steal, like, you know, picking up a shoe and killing a spider on the wall as opposed to capturing it and putting it outside or something. To see that movement and to recognize what's happening here. You know, what's going on inwardly that the mind, that I want to do that. And to not repress that, to not do it. But again, it's this middle way, neither repress nor express. What might it mean to not repress that hatred of that spider, but also not follow through on killing it? You know, I had this interesting experience at my family. I had gotten to this place where I really just didn't like to kill insects or anything, and my parents live in the South, and there's a lot of bugs in the South, and a wasp had come in to the house, and my dad got out the fly swatter, and I said, "Oh!" I felt a little like clench of just feeling this, you know, both the intention to kill and the pain of the being that was going to be killed. And I said, "I'd rather catch it and put it outside." And he said, "Well, okay, but you'll get stung." And I said, no, it's okay. And so I took a cup and I put it over the wasp, and I put a piece of paper on the other side, and I took it outside. And I had a couple of opportunities to do this while I was there. And then one day, we had noticed in my family's in the living room that there was a gecko or a lizard or something that was wandering around. And I came back one day after being out. My mom and I had gone out somewhere, and I came back, and there was a big bowl on the counter. And my mom said, "Why is this bowl out?" And my dad said, "That's what I use to catch the lizard." And I thought, wow. You know, because I think he normally would have just tried to kill it, but, you know, he had seen how I had done that, and I felt like, wow, that was contagious. So, you know, it just was a delight. It was a nice, like, pointing to the way that relationship and the wholesome qualities and the practice is contagious. So, let's see if there's anything else. I guess I'll just end with this one little piece. There's 2 minutes left. So this kind of exchange of, you know, that we that it's helpful for us both to practice non-harming conduct for ourselves and for others reminds me of the story of the acrobats. And I won't read this so much, but just summarize it. It's a teaching story that the Buddha offers, and there's a story of a acrobat in training and a master acrobat, and the master acrobat says to the acrobat in training, "So when we go up to do our trick on the bamboo pole, you look after me and I look after you, and in that way we will come down safely from our trick." And the acrobat in training said, "Well, I see it a little differently. To me, it feels like I should look after myself and you should look after yourself, and then we'll be safe." And the Buddha actually agreed with both, but he first emphasized that, yes, the acrobat in training is right, that we have to look after ourselves in order. If in looking after ourselves, we will be looking after others. And then he said, and also in looking after others, we will be looking after ourselves. And he pointed to, what does it mean in looking after ourselves, we look after others? He pointed to the practice of mindfulness as being how we look after ourselves. And if we engage with being aware of what we're doing, how we are, what what's going on in our hearts and minds, it will have the impact of being able to recognize when we may be getting ready to do something. And so that action of being aware of our own hearts and minds does support and create a connection with others. And then the other way, he said, looking after others, we take care of ourselves. He said, that's loving kindness. Actually, he said several things. He said, how is it that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, by harmlessness, so by ethics, by loving kindness, and by sympathy. In such a way, by protecting others, we protect ourselves. And so, you know, by being, just one example, by engaging in ethical conduct, we are definitely protecting others. We are creating the conditions for them not to be harmed. And that protects us from the consequences of harming someone else, from the remorse, but also the possible, you know, ripple effects out that might happen when we harm somebody else. So this kind of reciprocity of friendship, that we both take care of ourselves and we take care of others. And so, thank you for your attention.